You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Declan Clark. He's calling from Berlin. Declan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So Declan, let's talk about what you're working on now. I'd like to perhaps talk about past projects too, but just to jump right into it, what are you working on or making at the moment?
Well, I'm currently writing a film that I'm going to be shooting in Romania in April or May, I think. It's for an exhibition in June. I'm developing it. I'm writing it with a Romanian curator I know called Ștefan Tiron, who I worked with in the past, and we were invited to do this exhibition in the kind of standard way that perhaps he would curate the exhibition and I would be the exhibiting artist, but we decided to take a different route through it. So we're kind of writing this film and he's going to play the lead character in it. So in some ways we're going to reverse those roles. So the director will be kind of scrutinizing the curator in this role. So it should be an interesting project, I'm hoping. It's tricky trying to orchestrate everything, financially, of course, as well. Films are always very expensive, particularly when you don't have much money. But that's what we're working on. And just to give you a brief outline, it's a film that looks at alternate realities. So the character, the kind of tone of the film comes out of recent films I've been making, the kind of noirish espionage type films. So the character will be in an alternate reality where communism collapsed in 89 but didn't disappear totally. So, you know, they went away and dropped the comrade and wore open-neck shirts and somehow revived in 2008 after the economic crash. So it's set in this alternate reality, and the character is predicting a worst-case scenario in a fictional reality, which turns out to be our current reality. So it's kind of using this template to reflect on what's happening in Europe now, what's happening globally now, and the kind of great political turmoil that we are in the midst of.
That sounds really interesting. I'd like to ask you a few things about that. One is, I mean, you talk about funding. I want to talk about that. We don't have to talk about that right away, but why Romania? And this is also a narrative film, right? This is a film, it sounds like, with a fairly clear message about politics.
Yeah, well, a lot of the work I've made over the last 15 plus years has been using moving image, but also at its core, there's always political content. I mean, that it's something that is very influential and important to me. And it's something that always kind of quite organically found its way into the work. It's never something I had to shoehorn in. And so this manifests itself in different ways in different films and obviously has evolved throughout the past decade plus, but I guess I developed a more narrative style of filmmaking in recent years. Starting with 2013, I made a film called We Are Not Like Them, which was heavily influenced by early documentary filmmaking and Central European cinema from the kind of 50s, 60s, that sort of period. And maybe Western European films, like people like Jean-Pierre Melville from the late 60s. So this kind of evolved into a trilogy. And then last year I made another film called The Hopeless End of a Great Dream, which kind of reflected on, it was commissioned as part of the 1916 commemorations by Temple Bar Gallery. So in Ireland, this was Temple Bar Gallery in Dublin, that is. In Ireland, obviously, with the anniversary of the 1916 Rising, this kind of topic was everywhere. I guess to Temple Bar Gallery and also a couple of other institutions, the Centre Culturel Irlandais in Paris and Belfast Exposed in Belfast and Trinity College Dublin were also part of the commission. I'm kind of answering your question here about funding inadvertently. I guess that the practice has leans itself towards these sort of subject matters. So the reason it was in Romania was because I first met Stefan Tiron about 2008, I think it was, and he invited me to do an exhibition alongside Jesse Jones, an Irish artist. And we did a two-person show then, and I developed a good relationship with him, and I've spent a lot of time in Romania since, and incidentally, I'm heavily influenced by contemporary Romanian cinema. So it was, I guess, Salon de Proiecte, the space that has invited us to do the exhibition, kind of felt maybe it would be a good time for us to come back and do something in Romania together, Stefan and I. And he saw the recent films I'd made and these kind of more feature length, the last two films have been over an hour, and was really interested in this kind of language I'd developed and wanted to work with that. So that's kind of how this all came about, and I guess he and I have always had a kind of interesting discussions in and around politics and history and how that manifests itself, and certainly that's how the initial discourse between us began, because he saw a film I made about Rosa Luxemburg called Minor of Trouble. So so it kind of all organically came about like that.
So you talked about a few things. You know, there was also what you did in 2013, as you were talking about funding and commissions. But I'd like to talk a little bit about some of that work and maybe go back to 2011 and 12, because that's when it was a film that was shortlisted for representing Ireland in the Venice Biennale. Is that correct?
Yeah. That was the film that I mentioned there, We Are Not Like Them. And it was a film that I'd been moving towards longer films. I made a film in, I think it was 2012, called Cologne Overnight, that looked at the Allied bombing of Cologne and its relationship to Heinrich Böll, the German Nobel Prize laureate, who was from Cologne and returned from the war to this city that had been turned into a moonscape and was deeply traumatized by that. And I connected the film to his experiences in the west of Ireland, where he came to rise in the late 50s and 60s and encountered these abandoned villages, which were famine villages, where the population had either died during the Irish famine or emigrated on the coffin ships to the United States, and well, no one knows if they made it or how many of them may have done. So he was really affected by this and this idea of how ruins come into being, either through violence or through other reasons. And he didn't necessarily equate the famine or these abandoned villages with violence, but of course they did come about through a form of violence, maybe perhaps a less direct and obvious one, such as bombing. And the film also then kind of equated that with the 2008 economic collapse and how Ireland had been in this boom economy and was building a lot of new houses. And then once the economy collapsed, as it did everywhere, all these half-built buildings were left in the city. So I was kind of struck by this idea that Ireland had waited throughout its history to get rich and then quickly built ruins again, unintentionally. So out of
right,
that came...
That's so ironic, and in a way kind of, I mean, not picturesque, but very visual. I don't know that about Ireland, but the idea of half-built buildings everywhere is sounds like it must be an incredible sight as well.
Yeah, it was. And I think the whole experience was quite a shock. I mean, as you can imagine, Ireland was just a desperately poor place throughout its history and a thoroughly exploited place for several hundred years of recent history. And then suddenly it got cash rich on EU money and became very, very wealthy. And like a lot of nouveau riche people and cultures, it spent. And then, you know, it's a small island, adrift of Europe. When the crash came, it landed with a loud bang in Ireland. And, I mean, the country's still feeling the ramifications of that. So, yeah, I was interested in a way of kind of trying to talk about that, but also to kind of capture how the city looked like. And there was this kind of direct correlation between its goals and intentions and what it was building towards, almost like a Tower of Babel, this, you know, building up to the skies that could never get there. So that film, you know, I think that was about 17 or 18 minutes long, but it kind of really opened up a vista in the work. And the film We Are Not Like Them was a much more expansive film, and it ended up being, I think, about 45 minutes in length. And I shot it all on 16 millimeter. Shot some of it myself.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So 16 millimeter, I mean, you know, that's a beautiful format, but also really expensive to shoot, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was quite lucky in a sense that I used to shoot on like DV and, you know, the sort of pre-digital formats that were semi-digital. But when I moved to film, I found it, and the film Cologne Overnight was kind of partly shot on film and partly on HD. You have to be so economical with 16mm film that actually I kind of really enjoyed it, because it meant rather than shooting 20 different shots and then deciding to edit 7 of them together, you just shoot the 7 you need. So... And, you know, particularly with We're Not Like Them, because it was quite a long film, I was very, I mean, I probably used about 90% to 95% of what I shot, which is, you know, normally you use about 25%. That would be the 20 to 25% would be the kind of industry standard. So, yeah, so to me, I really wanted to use this film, because when cinema... was first invented, you know, it was this wonderful modernist art form, the ultimate modernist art form, and it was just used to document everything. So the whole industrial transformation of Europe in particular, but the United States and most of the northern hemisphere of the planet were documented rigorously with black and white moving film. And I was kind of in the film reflects on this idea of the collapse of industrialization and the end of this era, and so I wanted to use 16mm film, black and white 16mm film, to record this, because almost to bookend the century and to document places in Europe where industrialization had begun, places like Newcastle upon Tyne, which at one point was the largest shipbuilding area in the world. And now they don't build ships there. There's only one active shipyard, and it just deconstructs ships. So the film connected that with a place called Eisenhüttenstadt, which is a city on the East German-Polish border, and another city called Nowa Huta, which is just on the outskirts of Krakow in Poland. And both these cities were this Soviet model in after the war, when Europe... Central Europe was just wiped out. They had to rebuild it. And so they decided they would, based on the model of Magnitogorsk, a city in the Soviet Union, that they would build cities around steelworks. And they would also get the workers to build their own cities. So it was quite a radical endeavor. And these cities existed and kind of flourished for a time. Eisenhüttenstadt, I think at one point in the 60s, was the youngest city, as in per capita population. It had the youngest in Europe. So it was quite radical. But then, you know, because of the economic collapse of communism, and then subsequently 1989 and the fleeing of the population from Central Europe, the cities have really struggled, and now they're kind of largely populated by older inhabitants. Which, and again, there's something quite amazing about that. If you go to a city and essentially the center of the city is populated by women in their 70s. These are always seen as failed cities, but I struggle to see them as failed cities. I just see them as different cities. And then these were connected with a school in Paris in the Alfortville region, which is called the October School. And to my knowledge, it's the only school in Europe named after the October Revolution. So these kind of four locations were brought together in this kind of espionage narrative that also kind of used as its spine Yevgeny Zamyatin's We, which was the first dystopian science fiction novel written in Europe. I think the first one ever was by Jack London, but the first one in Europe anyway was by Zamyatin, and he had begun writing this novel in Newcastle, where he was based designing, he was a naval engineer, he was designing icebreakers. And then ironically with this book, he came back to Russia just before the October Revolution, finished the book there, and when it came up to be published in 1922, Gavlis, the Soviet government's literary supervisors, deemed it an unfair critique of communism and banned it. But the book was actually written as a critique of the Newcastle bourgeoisie. So there's this interesting kind of cross-reading of the work, and it then became championed by all these exiled white Russians as a critique of the Soviet Union. And so somehow through its banning, it also ended up becoming that, even though it wasn't written or intended as that. And he ended up exiled, Zamyatin, to Paris and died there. So anyway, obviously it's quite a dense film, but because of the style of the film, there's a lot of very, very long takes, and the camera's very steady. And the narrative only takes up quite a small section. So in some ways, the film inverts the process. So the narrative of the film are establishing shots of these locations, and the establishing shots are this narrative where an agent goes to some locations and tries to determine some information and meet some people who never show up. So it's kind of a film in which nothing happens perpetually, so to speak.
But at the same time, there's a thread of narrative that runs through it that's also like an espionage thriller aspect, or no?
Yes, no, there is, yes. So it's this character that, again, this is the way you kind of make films cheaply. I played the character because I figured I was going to have to shoot in like four different countries, which would be very expensive to bring an actor to four cities, so I was trying to make it for the least amount of money possible. So I, either fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, was old enough to play the character by being in my mid-30s, so I just brought a trench coat and a suit and worked with the cinematographer, and then when I needed to be in front of camera, we'd work out the shots, and I'd just sit or walk in front of the camera. So it was actually a really interesting way of working, and I deliberately made it without sound because all the early documentary films, even the ones going into the 20s and 30s, films by people like Paul Rotha, who's an amazing British documentary filmmaker, were made without sound, and the sound was done after. So this film is completely silent. There's absolutely no audio. So that just meant it was myself and a cinematographer. So it was a very, very pared-down crew. And I guess a lot of the work I've made since, certainly in the last 4 years, has really come out of that film. Like it became a real shifting point in the work. And so this kind of, yes, you know, it had this espionage thread, but that was something very much a very small part of the film. But in recent years, the kind of narrative threads in the film have become more prominent.
So the one you're doing in Romania now, that will also have a quite a prominent narrative as well?
Yes, yeah, I think so. And then there's actually two other films I'm working on which will also have quite a prominent narrative aspect to them as well. And certainly the last film I made, I mentioned it earlier, The Hopeless End of a Great Dream. That was the first time I used actors. I mean, I've had some people in the films, but they weren't necessarily acting or speaking dialogue. And so that's something that has emerged slowly in the work and is something that will develop and expand, but I'm not quite sure yet, because the key is always funding and how to get enough funding to make the films you want to make, but also how to not get too much funding so you can make the film exactly the way you want to make it. Because for me, there's no point in making a film that you don't have complete control over, because then you're just, you know, working for someone else or with someone else.
Too much funding, you never know. Having a producer or something like that. I mean, having a producer or somebody who's then supporting it enough that they're making creative decisions.
Well, I produce my own films. I did work. I made a film about Friedrich Engels and also about the beginning of industrialization in Europe. Called The Most Cruel of All Goddesses. And I worked with a producer on that film, Sarah Perks, who's the artistic director of Home in Manchester. But Sarah is amazing, and I have a very good working relationship with her. So she didn't have any influence over the content, and she was quite happy to let me kind of have complete creative control over the film I was making. And then all the other films I've made, I've produced myself. So,
So why do you think that overfunding would create a problem? I mean, that's kind of an interesting a point there, because of course this is going to be shown in a gallery, or the one we've been talking about, the film that's going to be shot in Romania. And is there a limit for funding where you feel that it begins to get out of your hand or something? Is there a line there?
Well, I've been told there is. Unfortunately, I haven't encountered it. But I was talking to some friends of mine who make films, and they were saying that literally once you get over about 150,000 euro, that sort of mark, the decisions get taken away. Now, I've never made a film for anywhere near that amount, not even close. But it's just really about, for me, the most important thing is having complete control.
Sure.
And I'm used to working on a really, really tight budget. So the last film I had had a more expansive budget because we had a lot of funding bodies that came in. But because they all came in with significant amounts, but smaller installments in some cases. The Irish Arts Council contributed quite a lot. Certainly, they were incredibly supportive.
So it's through grants. I mean, a lot of the money raised is through grants and non-profits.
Yeah, it was all through grants. For the last film.
Grants.
Pardon me. Sorry.
It's all grants. It's as opposed to private individuals as well.
Oh, yeah, it's all grants. So that's the way my work has always gone. There's always been either a grant or my own money or some sort of commissioning body that's usually a public institution. I've never used private funding, not that I'm against it. It's not something that's ever materialized in my case.
And so that's exciting to know that one will be shown in a gallery. When it is shown in a gallery, how is that set up? Or how do you imagine the project that's going to Romania now will be screened in a gallery? Or will there be specific times people come in? Is it part of an installation? Or is it kind of like turning it into a movie theater?
Well, I guess a bit of both. I mean, in some ways, as you said, the films are, for me anyway, I always make them specifically with a gallery context in mind, because I'm an artist and that's where I come from, that's my history, and that's what I look to. Though, of course, the cinema has had a huge, huge influence on my work and on my thinking and on my outlook. And recent films, starting with We Are Not Like Them, which I was speaking about, have shown in film festivals. So the work is kind of crossing over into that area now. Much to my surprise, it's not something that I initiated. It just kind of happened. and a really incredible experience, and one I welcome and would like to look into more. But no, for me, I make them with a gallery in mind, and when I'm installing the work, it tends to, in some ways, I guess, recreate a cinema type environment where you black out the room and, you know, use a very particular type of projector and a particular type of sound, and so you can really focus on the film. And what I tend to do is, what's one of the things I like about art and the art gallery is that, much derided as it is for whatever reason, it really allows a freedom to the viewer. Firstly, they rarely have to pay in, and secondly, you can come and go as you please. So if you're, you know, watching something that's an hour long and you only feel like watching 5 minutes, you have the freedom to do so, which I think is a positive. But the way I screen the films is I usually put up screening times, and, you know, it happens, let's say, on the hour or every 80 minutes or so. So people, if they want, can watch the whole thing from start to finish, but they don't necessarily have to view it in that way.
I mean, maybe go on, but why just Berlin? Berlin is, you're living in Berlin. You could live in a lot of different places and have. Why work in Berlin as an artist at this moment in this year?
Well, I lived in Berlin first in 1994 and 1995 when I was a student. I came here for the summers. And it was a really interesting time, of course, because it was the post-Mauer period. So that really struck a chord and was something that I always wanted to come back to the city anyway. And then when I started making I was spending more and more time here because I had some friends living here and that I was working with, and I'd be coming over and back from London and also from Dublin. I was doing a residency there in the fire station for a number of years. And then I started making the film about Heinrich Böll, and so it made sense to be in Germany. And then just in terms of the research I'd been doing in the work a long time, Central Europe just seemed a better place and a more appropriate place to be. And certainly looking back over the last 8 years, it's been terrific being based in Central Europe in terms of the work and also in terms of...
And in terms of work, meaning work to make a living, that kind of work, or...
No, I mean the work as in the films and the research I've been doing in and around the films. It's very different. You know, I grew up in Ireland and I lived in London for 10 years. I lived in New York for a year, but in some ways New York is kind of an island within a large country, a very, very large country. And England and Ireland are both islands. So having lived most of my life on an island, to live in the center of a large landmass where you have a lot of different countries all bordering each other, all speaking, with, you know, a shared history because of all the wars and transformations that have happened in Europe over the last several hundred years, but also just languages and cultures rubbing up against each other. And it's a really interesting place, I have to say, Central Europe. And, you know, the fact that you can, a city like Berlin is quite north and quite east, much more so than you think. So, you know, you're very, very close to Poland. You're very, very close to the Czech Republic. You're very close. You're not far from Holland. You're not far from Belgium. You're not far from France even, you know. You're an overnight train ride from Paris. So it's very interesting location, you know, right on the cusp of East and West and slap bang in the middle of Central Europe, which is a very, very interesting place politically, culturally, historically, linguistically. I mean, you name it. There's a lot happening here and has been for a long period of time. So it's a very rich environment and one that has been hugely beneficial to me personally in terms of inspiration and sourcing ideas and so many things. It's difficult to put it in words.
It's exciting. It sounds like an exciting place to be.
And it's great hearing about your work, but before we go, I want to ask you what I ask everybody at the end, which is, can you tell me what you're reading at the moment?
I'm currently reading a book as research. Well, I'm reading several books, but the one I literally just started this morning is Alfred Bester's The Star Is My Destination, which is, thus far, I'm only about 100 pages into it, a really terrific, terrific, terrific book. It's got a very good reputation of being the kind of quintessential political science fiction masterpiece. So I'm a huge, huge fan of Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed. I think it's a marvelous novel, a marvelous political novel. And so this one, thus far, seems to be on a par with that. So I'm thoroughly enjoying it and intend on spending the next 2 days completing it.
Declan, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been great getting to know your work.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure talking with you also.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.